You're listening to a 3CR podcast recorded in the 3CR Community Radio Studio in Melbourne, Australia. If you like what you hear, please consider donating or subscribing so we can keep bringing you more independent community content. For more information, go to 3cr.org.au.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double.
Grab your pants.
You're listening to 3CR. This is Marty from the Wednesday Breakfast team. This is our summer programming. And this morning we're going to hear an interview from Jesse, who's part of the Wednesday Breakfast team, when he spoke with Associate Professor Holly Hai, who is a specialist on Laos, the one-party socialist state. Holly has focused her studies on Laos, conducting fieldwork, and has held postdoctoral positions at Yale, Cambridge, and in Sydney. Here in this first section of this interview with Holly, we hear about how democracy functions in Laos.
Not many people really think about Laos much or really know much about Laos in Australia. And I was hoping maybe you could situate where Laos is and geographically, and maybe a little bit around the culture and, you know, obviously its neighboring countries and how and where Laos is kind of at now.
Okay, great. So Laos, or the Lao People's Democratic Republic, as it's been known since 1975, is in the heart of Southeast Asia. It's the only landlocked country in Southeast Asia. It's surrounded by China to the north, Myanmar, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. The people who live there are about 50%, roughly more than half, just a bit more than half the population is ethnic Lao. They speak a language which is similar to Thai, and they cluster sort of around the Mekong Valley and historically were wet rice farmers in the sort of fertile plains around the river. And up in the highlands to the north and along the border with Vietnam, you get a lot of different ethnic groups, including Austroasiatics, the Hmong, all kinds of, about half the population are split up into small ethnic minorities. So the country has its roots in French Indochina. There was, that's when the sort of idea of Laos that's roughly correlates with the current borders was first conceived of. I guess going back further, there were sort of ancient kingdoms like Lanzang and that sort of thing. But modern Laos emerged in the colonial and post-colonial era. And so today Laos is, I don't know, a population of about 6 or 7 million and one of the poorest countries of Southeast Asia, but also one that's quickly growing. It's had some of the highest economic growth rates in the region up until COVID. It suffered quite a lot during COVID, not so much because of the pandemic itself. People were quite robust in the face of the pandemic. There weren't a huge amount of deaths and they handled the pandemic very well in terms of rolling out the vaccine and that sort of thing. But the economic fallout from the pandemic has hit the country really hard, especially in terms of devaluing the currency and a lot of inflation related to, I guess, shocks from the international economy, such as when the United States started putting up interest rates that really impacted Laos because a lot of their debts are in foreign currencies and inflation has compounded that. So there's a lot of concern around the economy in Laos at the moment. So that's sort of where we're up to.
Thank you. And I'm hoping we can focus a bit on, or mostly on, the politics in Laos and sort of how that works, and maybe focus on some examples that can sort of point out or exemplify some of the differences, because it is a one-party socialist state, and not you know, that's kind of a foreign concept, I think, to many of us here in Australia. And there might be a lot of ideas about what that might mean, but also just very curious about what it actually does mean and what it means for people living there. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how the political framework is designed there, how politics works there for people who are in politics, but also for the people who live in Laos?
Sure. So it's a People's Democratic Republic. So this was the result of a 30-year struggle against first French colonialism and then US intervention. Laos is the most heavily bombed country in the world per capita. A lot of the Ho Chi Minh Trail ran through Lao territory during the war, and there was also a lot of concern about the strategic importance of the Plain of Jars in Laos, which is a big plain to the north. This was the era of the domino theory of communism. The idea was that if China had already fallen to communism and Vietnam North Vietnam had fallen, then Laos would fall and then Thailand would fall. So there was this idea that if they could halt the spread of communism there, that would stop the global spread of communism. So Laos was just very heavily bombarded. And actually, when there were moratoriums against the bombing in North Vietnam, which were sort of great victories for the peace movement here in Australia and America when they stopped the bombing on North Vietnam, the sad news is that those planes were redirected over Laos. They didn't stop bombing. They just bombed in secret another country. So Laos had a very long, drawn-out struggle. And this was led by Gaysom Pomvihan, who was the military leader of the movement, but also the leader in political thought, and he was very influenced by Marxist-Leninist ideas. And so he conceived of the struggle as a people's struggle for national independence. And part of this was the decision-making process of democratic centralism. So the idea was that, you know, this is a war for independence. We're not mucking around here, so there has to be centralism. Centralism means when a decision is made, everybody sticks to it. But it also has to be democratic, because what are we fighting for? We're fighting for freedom. We're fighting for independence. So the way we fight the battle has to reflect the values that we're actually fighting for. So what does democracy mean here? Well, for him, democracy meant that everybody has to have a say in decisions. So before a decision is made, there's extensive consultation. And they viewed this as a really important plank of how they won the war. Is that it wasn't a top-down thing. It was a bottom-up movement, mobilizing what they called a people's war, drawing on people's intimate knowledge of landscapes, the way that they knew what the French were doing, and they could inform on that. They could have women carrying babies. They could have children. They could have old people all involved in the movement, contributing either information or rice or transporting things. Everybody could contribute. So that's what they mean by democracy, is it's a mass movement that everybody contributes to, and everybody's valued, and everybody has an opinion that can be listened to and heard in a consultative manner. But then a decision is made, often by vote, and once that decision is made, there is no dissent. Everybody gets behind the decision. Okay, so that's democratic centralism. And you can see how, in the context of a war, a people's war, that is a very effective strategy. And I think that is why Marxist-Leninist movements have so often been the only ones who have successfully fought in these sort of anti-colonial nationalist struggles. So as a philosophy for leading a war, it's fantastic. And then they gained power, and they had to transfer this into a philosophy for leading a nation, a new nation that had suffered incredible setbacks due to bombardment and then slapped with embargoes, trade embargoes from the United States and Thailand. That's incredible for a landlocked country to have your closest port put a trade embargo on you. So they had economic sanctions. There were also border disputes with Thailand. There was tension with China because of the conflict in Cambodia. So they were very, as soon as they gained independence, they were in a very precarious position. They also had sort of counter-revolutionary movements based in the refugee camps in Thailand and also in Yunnan, China, that were, you know, being supported by foreign powers to try to undermine the new regime. So they were struggling. There was a very tough few years. And in this context, they wanted to start a People's Republic based on this concept of democratic centralist decision making. So again, a mass movement where everybody contributes to decision making, but at the same time, there's a great deal of unity. Once a decision's made, everybody gets behind it, and you're able to sort of draw on the strength of cooperation and mutuality across society, so not constantly divided. Yeah, so you can see in the post-war period, there was a really big emphasis put on unity. So one aspect of this is unity across ethnicities. It's a very ethnic diverse country. So looking at Laos today, you can start to see, you know, some of the effectiveness of this approach of unity, the emphasis put on unity compared to other countries in the region. Laos is more ethnically diverse, sort of statistically speaking, it has a higher proportion of small ethnicities as part of its population than Myanmar does. But there is nothing comparable in Laos to what's going on in Burma in terms of ethnic conflicts. The same could be said of Thailand. Thailand's really impacted by ethnic tensions, especially in the south. There's been an ongoing armed conflicts between the Muslim minorities and the Thai majority in the south of Thailand. Although I think in the south, actually, the Muslims are the majority. But there's nothing like that in Laos. Not these days, anyway. Not since the counter-revolutionary movements have dried up. So an emphasis on unity has been really important in the post-war period, and that's the kind of reflection of this emphasis on centralism, so that you have democracy but with a centralist endpoint, you know. So you have an ethnically diverse country that has unity. You have a style of democracy that's based on the concept that in the end you have a unified direction. Yeah. So how does that work in practice? Because like when we think about democracy, literally, if you ask a person on the street in Australia, if you ask what is a democratic country, they'll probably say something like, oh, that you have lots of different political parties and lots of different points of view. Right. So in Laos, they don't have lots of different political parties. They have one. And although there are lots of different points of view, in the end, they have, you know, party resolutions, which are, you know, to an outside person, it looks like they're just pronounced by the Politburo as this is the resolution, now everybody has to follow it. So it looks very much like the opposite of what we think democracy is. So how do they have the guts to stand up and call themselves the People's Democratic Republic of Laos? Like, a lot of people coming from overseas just dismiss this as empty rhetoric. It's just ideology. It's just propaganda. But I was lucky enough to do a research project that was funded by the Australian government, a little research agency called the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. And they wanted to know why some of the projects that they fund in agricultural research have big policy impact and some have no policy impact at all, because they want to fund projects that actually change the way things are done in Laos for the better in terms of agricultural production. So they asked me as an anthropologist if I had any insight into policy processes in Laos. And so we did. We had a great research team of local anthropologists and also Australian researchers. And we got to do ethnographic research following the formation of a policy document, the forestry policy, the forestry strategy. And we also attended the National Assembly of Laos and watched how people gave political speeches and how they dealt with live issues. And what I learned from that process is, and what I saw people doing, was this sort of consultation. And like, so in the National Assembly, people stand up and give their opinions, right? And which doesn't sound that surprising, but it's not what we think happens in a one-party authoritarian dictatorial dictatorship. Sorry, you can edit that. So what's going on here? Why do people stand up and spend time giving impassioned speeches on topics if their input has no importance? And same with the forestry strategy. Like, these are strategies that are released every 10 years, and that full 10 years, like, as soon as a strategy is released, basically the consultation process begins again for the next one. Like, there are these sort of meetings at sort of district level, maybe feeding up from the village level to the district level to the provincial level to the national level, and then the strategy's made, and then it goes back down to the other levels for comment, and then these comments are fed back up and it's revised, and then the revised document is trialed, and once it's trialed, feedback is given on the trial document, and there's just all of this consultation. And we've started asking people, why is there so much consultation going on? Like, why do people, willingly sit in these meetings and devote so much time to this? And we came back to this concept of democratic centralism as, the way policies are designed, the way people's input into to policy directions is, it's all guided by this concept of democratic centralism. So at this point, I realized I really had to dig into this and try to understand how this the history of this concept, and also how it had been adopted in the Lao setting. And of course, for anything that's been viable for this long, democratic centralism was something that was first coined, I think, back in, Lenin was not the first one to use it, I'll put it that way. I don't, but he picked it up, and the meaning of it back then was this incredible period in pre-Soviet Russia, I guess, of everybody contributing their thoughts, and there was an era of great debate, and there was this idea that it would be, contrary to the previous regime where people had been, very limited in what they could say or do, that it would be this that democracy with this sort of very vibrant contribution from all parties, but at the same time moving in a coherent direction under the centralist principle. But this got reinterpreted under Stalinism to be more centralist, and it's been reinterpreted. So, for instance, the International Communist Movement, what was it, Comintern? By the time this sort of spread to Laos, so democratic centralism became one of the principles of decision making that other Marxist-Leninist movements had to adopt if they wanted to be part of Comintern. So that's how it sort of got exported around the world. But at the same time, it sort of got reinterpreted everywhere, everywhere it went. And I sort of see this, like, thinking about how it evolved in Laos, is that it seems to be part of the principle itself. Because there are two poles, democracy on the one hand and centralism on the other, at different points of time and in different places, there's a big variety in how much emphasis is put on one or the other. So it becomes quite a flexible concept. So in wartime, you can imagine that there might be a more abundance of centralism, and in times of peace and prosperity, there might be more room for democracy. I thought that, but then when I was reading more about the history of the war in Laos, did you know that at Dien Bien Phu, when they were fighting the French, and it was this huge all-out battle, and the Lao were involved in this, had some very important roles in this struggle. At one point, General Giap, the leader of the movement, called a halt to to everything, and he wrote this in his memoirs of the battle. He said he had to call a halt to the struggle because there were too much too much emphasis on centralism, and he wanted people to reconnect with the democratic principles.
Wow.
And so, yeah, he says there. He said there were rightist tendencies emerging at the battlefront, and by that he meant like people being too like ordering one another around and not being consultative enough. And so he called a whole bunch of people who couldn't get more consultative, and then they got back into it. Yeah, so it's sometimes surprising.
Hi, this is Jesse from 3CR Wednesday Breakfast, and you're listening to summer programming on 3CR.
You're on 3CR, our summer programming, and we're listening to a multi-part interview with Associate Professor Holly High, speaking about Laos.
What I see in Gaysland speeches, and this is still very much in process research, he had the idea that society has to become ready for democracy. So he was looking at the context of the war, the international, like this is in the post-war period. There was a lot of damage from the war. There were immediate needs that had to be met, like restoring bombed territories so that they could grow food on them, and rebuilding infrastructure, and also a new economic context where, you know, having gone from a period where the economy was very dependent on US aid during the war, you know, they were pumping millions of dollars in, that had suddenly gone. So they had to rebuild the economy from scratch. And they also had a population, many of whom had been very disrupted by the war. A lot of know, people with not great health due to displacement from the war, and also illiteracy was a big problem. So he felt that what he called the quality of the population had to be lifted up first before they could participate in democracy. And I know this sounds very offensive from our point of view, but looking at the last, 50 years now, next year will be the 50th year anniversary of the establishment of the Lao People's Democratic Republic. In that 50 years, you can see that they have put in more and more opportunities for broad-based consultation in their political structure. So the National Assembly has become more prominent in terms of guiding policies. When I started doing fieldwork in Laos, district chiefs were appointed, but now they're elected. Elections are now commonplace events in villages where the village chief gets elected, the village head is an elected position, and so are their deputies. And so this is, whereas when I started doing fieldwork, which was in, my first field site was in Champasak in the year 2002, in that year, the village chief was an appointed position, but they've transitioned to making these elected positions. So, you know, it's easy to be cynical about Gaison's statement that democracy is something that requires a certain base level in the population. But he says again and again, you know, democracy is something that will grow and improve as the population grows and improves. And it's something that comes along with prosperity. So in the early years, he really emphasized economic development, economic growth. And so there was this idea early on that this could be achieved through centrally planned collectivization. So they tried to collectivize agriculture. They started a lot of state-owned enterprises. But when these didn't work in terms of massively increasing production, they tried another tack and decentralized and made the collectives much, much smaller or made them optional. Yeah, so that was in pretty much they started rolling back the collectives in like 1979. And by 1986, Gaison Ponvihan, this political leader, had introduced a new economic mechanism. And interestingly, when he did that, and this was like market-based approaches to economic growth, interestingly, when he did that, again, he evoked the concept of democratic centralism. He said, this is democratic centralism because it is democratic to allow people to make their own economic decisions. And this is the way we feed into, you know, a progression towards economic development. So even, you know, like, that just goes to show how elastic this concept is. Like the collectivization of agriculture could be justified under democratic centralism. So could it deregulation of trade and returning to a sort of market-based economy. But, you know, it's easy to be cynical about this, but I think on the ground, when I go to Laos, I do see that there is a difference in politics just after, you know, this 80 years now, if you count the 30-year struggle plus 50 years of living in the People's Republic, that's 80 years where democratic centralism has been a key political paradigm in Laos in one guise or another. And when I observe politics in Laos, I see quite significant differences from Australia. And I think this goes through even to the most minute interactions. Like when we were doing ethnographic research in meetings, when we were following the policy, the production of the forestry strategy, we were comparing the rooms where only Lao people were and the room where the foreign people who had been invited, like, you know, other people who were involved in forestry, whether they be international business owners or working development agencies around forestry, they were sort of in the English-speaking room.
Interesting.
Yeah, and just the difference differences in how people carried themselves, how they interacted, was very striking. In the English-speaking room, people had quite a that was a cacophony. Like lots, everybody was talking and presenting their views from where they came from, and the person running the room said, you know, it's my job to, this is democratic centralism. He said, it's my job to provide a summary of all of our views at the end, which can feed into the consultation process. And he said, I actually don't know how to make a summary from all the different things that have been said today. There is no common thread. It's just like a whole bunch of different views. And the people in the English speaking room still have no problem with that. Like, they were just like, yeah, we're all different. whereas in the Lao room, where I was observing, I saw people were very quiet, like for a long time, people wouldn't say anything at all. And then when somebody did say something, this was really listened to and received by other people. And then the next person who spoke would try and build on that. And then at the end, everybody was very mindful that they had to produce a summary at the end that they could all agree on, or that they didn't, at least didn't dissent too much. And so they were all helping the leader of the room to create a summary because they knew that was the target of the meeting. Whereas I feel the people in the English speaking room had no idea or no real, hadn't really grasped the importance of the summary at the end. So it's like where we come from, we understand the bit where everybody present their opinions, but we don't have the centralist bit where at the end you have to all agree on something.
So,
and you could see the frustration from the person trying to run the English speaking room. They were like, the process doesn't actually work. Like, it's great that you all presented your opinions, but it doesn't actually lead anywhere if we can't make a summary at the end that draws that together. And then
that's so interesting.
Yeah. And then the Lao word for summary, salup, I was just like, my brain was just going, oh my God, because I've sat in so many meetings in Laos. And for like my PhD research was on basically attending meetings in Laos in a village setting. And at the end of every meeting, they have salup, 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 salup. And it's almost, so this means summary. And at the end, like when I did my research, my PhD research, I saw this as a kind of ritual thing. Like we all knew the end of the meeting was coming when someone said salup, like, okay, summarize. But then when I was observing it at this high level in the city, where they still do the summary, and I saw just how important it was, like the point of the meeting is to make the summary. And that's the bit which then feeds into the next stage of the consultation and the next stage and the next stage. Mm-hmm. So that really was a light bulb moment for me that I realized these weren't just rituals. This was a small part of a much bigger political philosophy about how you can have both. You know, it's not one or the other. You can have everybody giving their varied opinions, but you can also have unity. You can have democracy and you can have centralism. It's not one or the other. It's sort of a shuttling back and forth between them, even in the space of a one-hour meeting. You have a bit of this and a bit of that. Yeah.
Yango, 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 yango
3CR, our summer programming, and we're listening to a multi-part interview with Associate Professor Holly High, speaking about Laos.
Well, we don't have this idea of that we're in this together, and of course that famous Thatcher quote of there's no such thing as society comes to mind, and I feel like that is that very much, as much as that quote is ridiculous, it does have some truth to it in the way that our society is developed and designed, and from the time from all of our institutions, whether that's education or political institutions. So yeah, that's how I can kind of conceive of that in what you've just described in to the experience of, you know, growing up in Australia.
Can I build on that? I love that you thought about that quote, there is no such thing as society, because I think the thing that I've learned from watching Laos for so long, and over so many big and unexpected things, like especially COVID, I think what I learned is that there is no such thing as society unless you build it, you know, and that's the difference. Society is an incredibly strong and resilient and amazing thing, but it doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from all these daily interactions and practice and experience, putting up with the frustrations of dealing with other people. And I think in Australia, we've starved our society. We've starved those social capacities. And then when it really comes to the crunch, like something like COVID, it's not there. Mm. But in Laos, in 2002, I went to all these meetings and I was like, what the hell are these people doing? Like, they would have a day where every single household would have to send someone to the school to clean up the school grounds and repair the fence. And I would be like, good anthropologist, taking photos, taking notes, talking to people. Then another day, they'd have a day where everybody would have to send someone to work on the pathways, sweeping the pathways, cleaning the pathways. So they can do this in the city. If you're in Laos, sometimes you'll be lucky enough to just see a whole bunch of people with hats on out just picking up rubbish together, because everybody in Laos lives in a village. It's the smallest level of administration. Even if you live in the city, the cities are broken up into districts and villages, and you will at some point have to work with your village to do something like this. Okay, and so I was looking at this thinking, what is the bloody point of all of this? Like, these leaves are going to blow back on the path, and, you know, why are they doing this? But then when something like COVID came along, these people knew who their village was. Do you know what I mean? And they knew how to work together. They'd worked together before. Mm-hmm. And so when push came to shove, they were able to act pretty much independently of the state to secure their own local biosecurity. It was really inspiring because, like, because I live in a village that's, you know, at the moment I live in a village in rural Victoria, roughly the same size as a lot of the villages I work with in Laos. And the contrast was just stark. Like, here in Australia, I was not able to send my children to school, even though we're a tiny village, because we couldn't be sure that people wouldn't drive down from Melbourne and spread the virus locally. Whereas in Laos, when I spoke to my friends over there, when we reconnected after COVID, which was such a special time to see them again, and I said, how did you go during COVID? And they said, oh, you know, we just got together and we said, okay, all the old people stay in the village, and if we want to buy food from outside, one person will go, we'll all give this person our order and our money, they can go and get the food. They can be in quarantine for a few days when they come back. Our kids continue to go to school because the school teacher lives locally. They basically had no interruption to their daily life, except their interactions outside the village were smaller. But in terms of them continuing to do their main professions, in terms of continuing to send their kids to school, it was all uninterrupted. And the reason they were able to just even have those conversations is because they have those local networks that are built up through this very conscious effort that the Lao government has to build local capacity, to build strength in society at a local grass, what they call the grassroots level. Yeah. Mm,
that's incredible. And that example is very powerful, I think, for people in Melbourne, especially when we endured lots of lockdowns and A lot of mismanagement from government in terms of getting vaccines and, the whole affairs with the quarantines, but of course also the complete shutdown of the public housing towers, which was horrific. To contrast those experiences, I think is especially powerful and speaks to, even if we're thinking about things in economic terms, like that's amazing. Like it sounds like the Laos economy was able to really withstand, this COVID event without too much change or too much disruption.
Well, not so much the economy. I mean, the economy got shattered, but the social impact, in terms of people's emotional well-being, in terms of the continued education of children, the well-being of elderly people, that was all a lot stronger in Laos, I think. I'll give you another example. When I went up to another village I do field work in, it's very small, up in the remote mountains, so I can only go there when it's possible. They only just got a road, so I went last year. So I went on the road last year to see these people. I hadn't seen them for like 10 years. And it's a village of maybe 150 people. And they had built, I asked them what they did during COVID. And they said, oh, we just used our old, our old traditions of galum, which means taboo. So we just declared the whole village taboo, so nobody was allowed out and nobody was allowed in. And they showed me these, they'd carved these figures out of wood and placed them along the main footpath. At that time there was no road, so it was just a footpath to get into the village. And they said that was to communicate to, it was probably about 20 of these posts that were like carved like soldiers and other scary figures, and that was to communicate to anyone approaching that they weren't to come in. And that happened across Laos, like people reactivated these traditions that they had of around sickness as taboo, to just sort of like, so you might have seen when you go to Southeast Asia, bamboo skewers folded into the shape of a star. They're called daleo. They're in the north of Laos. So a lot of people put daleo around their villages or houses to just... So that I think in the history of humanity, including in Laos, you can find examples of the way people operated at a local level to have a sense of we. We do this together. We act collectively. And I think in the contemporary world, people still have, in some places, those traditions. And then there are also approaches to government and policy which can foster and enhance a sense of we. But I think in some countries, including Australia, maybe England, a lot of Europe and America, this sense of we has been undermined, or at least not fostered, not supported. And so what people looked for in that vacuum, I guess, is, ironically enough, government intervention. And I say it's ironic because when we think of a place like Laos, like when most people's idea of a one-party state is that you have this centralized government that's telling everyone what to do. And I see almost the opposite. I see, because they've invested so much in community and a local sense of we, people actually, the government often feels very distant there, and people don't look to the government first to solve their problems, put it that way. I wrote an article called It Wasn't the Government That Did It, it was Us. And it's an article about how this other village, a third village that I haven't spoken about yet, how they solved the problem of getting clean water, because they'd moved from a very remote area to a lowlands area because they were hoping to engage more with the economy, better schools, better hospitals, but it didn't have clean water. And so a lot of people got sick, a lot of people died. It was a big crisis. It was awful. But when I heard the story, it was told to me with a lot of pride, because in the end, the solution that worked was raising some money locally from amongst the various households to buy a clean spring, working like commissioning labor from a group of houses to do the labor of digging it out and putting charcoal in and filters and stuff and putting pipes in. And now every year, some guys from the, well, four times a year, someone walks around the village and collects money from people, and this goes towards the upkeep. And the person who organized it was really proud of it. He was saying, yeah, like, you know, all these people tried to help, like the health office, the government, NGOs, international organizations, but the solution that worked was when we did it. And, you know, he told me this story with a big smile, and it could be a story.
You're listening to a 3CR podcast. 3CR is an independent community radio station based in Melbourne, Australia. We need your financial support to keep going. Go to www.3cr.org.au for more information and to donate online. Now stay tuned to hear the rest of your 3CR podcast.
That was written as this horrible tragedy of how all these people died because they were resettled and there wasn't adequate water and stuff. But the story he wanted to tell was we solved this problem ourselves. And I'm struck with the contrast here in Australia when I'm just looking at how social problems get solved. Again and again, people here just look to the government. And I find that quite ironic because Laos is meant to be the one-party totalitarian state. But I actually see everyday people there have a lot more of an independent mindset in terms of solving problems themselves, working locally to sort out their own issues. And also I feel there's a lot of pushback when the state does try to act in Laos. They often receive a lot of pushback from everyday people. So it's maybe not the monolithic sort of scary place that people visiting tourists often think it is when they go to Laos. Yeah.
Hi, this is Jesse from 3CR Wednesday Breakfast, and you're listening to summer programming on 3CR.
We're listening to a multi-part interview with Associate Professor Holly High speaking about Laos.
When we were doing our research into policy making in Laos, I did get some videos of Australian Question Time and show them to our Lao research team to get their feedback. Because the contrast between what we were seeing in the Lao National Assembly and what I thought of as Australian politics was just so vast. And so we tried to reflect on what those differences were. I wanted to hear their feedback. And they were, of course, shocked, as we all are, when we see the lack of civility, I guess. So we were able to interview some people from the National Assembly too, and asked them what they thought made a good intervention, like when they made a speech at the National Assembly or when they watched other people, what were they trying to achieve? And one person put it really nicely. He said, and he was an anthropologist actually. So you know it's good when the National Assembly has anthropologists elected to it. So he said, you know, It is democratic, but everybody has to be responsible for what they say. There's a great sense of responsibility. So democracy for him meant putting your opinion forward, but it just can't be like some opinion you pull from the sky. It has to be supported with evidence. It has to be something that you can back up with facts. It has to be something that's phrased in a way that, in the end, it's possible for everybody to get behind it. Even if you have differences in agreement and differences of opinion, you have to phrase those opinions in a way that unity in the end is possible. Because even at the end of the National Assembly speeches, where everybody gets up and says what they think, and sometimes it's very critical of the government, you know, people standing up saying, you know, we've got these problems with corruption, you know, people are standing up and saying very strong things, but they know at the end of the session, so look, there's going to be a summary. a summary has to be made. And in the summaries, they take out all the names. It doesn't matter who says it. It's the National Assembly said this, you know. So there's unity at the end. So everybody phrases their comments like in a very, very polite way. So we noticed that the usual format is to stand up and say, thank you for all the previous comments. I've listened to them with a great deal of interest, and I agree with what a lot of other people have said. This is where I differ, and this is, you know, so this incredible sort of courtesy. And, you know, you can, a lot of, I guess, people who are opposed to believing that there's anything good in Asian examples of Marxist-Leninist states would just say, oh, they're just, it's all just, it's just formulaic responses, you know, that there's, these are just empty hot air speeches that have no real seeds of change in them or whatever. But actually, if you look over the 50 years of Laos, there has been a lot of change, actually. There's been a lot of change in policy. In fact, one of the conclusions of our research project is that there's probably been a bit too much change, in that there's a real problem about policy churn in Laos, in that the people working sort of in, say, district level offices are just constantly getting these new policies rolling out that they have to implement, and it becomes too much. You get layers and layers of policy, which means that this is where the corruption can creep in, because people can say, oh, well, I'm doing it according to this regulation, but not that regulation. So it's actually sometimes better to not change policy. But nobody can honestly say that Laos has not been responsive in terms of policy. They've been ultra responsive. And so I don't believe that it's all just hot air. I think it's actually there's a genuine political philosophy motivating the way people present themselves in parliament, and this is about having democracy while having unity as the end goal. And the idea, which is almost sacrilegious to us, that the end point of democracy can be unity. It's quite absurd to now. I've been soaking in this for so long that I now think it's quite funny that I started out with the opinion that democracy is best when everybody's arguing with each other. I now just don't think I don't think you always have to be arguing in order to have a good outcome. Like, you just don't.
And so what does it look like? You mentioned, you know, there's so much consultation. I think there was a hotline set up.
Oh, yes. You can call the National Assembly. Yeah.
Call them. Like, what does the hotline mean? That sounds like to people growing up here, it's like, oh, you know, hotlines don't mean anything in Australia. Like, you can call a hotline and, you know, especially if it's directly to the government, and you think, oh, well, you know, I'll call my local minister, but, you know, if I disagree with something True. That they're doing, they're not going to listen to me. They're just going to, you know, in the case of many of them, they just don't listen to you, or they literally just cut their phone lines off so you can't contact them. In the case of our foreign minister's office.
I'd say it's pretty similar. Like, people call up the hotline and complain. Like, they got a lot of complaints during COVID with the school closures. Can you imagine how many people calling the hotline? And they were just like, because they did, in urban Laos, they did have school closures. That wasn't as brilliant as it was in my rural Laos field sites. So they got a lot of complaints. And so so what they do is they get it, if they get a few complaints on the same topic, they start to sort of tally them. So it's not individual things. It's like, we got 75 complaints about this sort of thing, rather than like going into one individual person's situation. So I think in a situation like that, people are going to feel dismissed or trivialized and that sort of thing. So I think the Laos situation is far from perfect. And when I speak positively about the Laos situation, it's not because I want to hold them up as doing everything right and Australia is everything wrong, but more that, you know, I would like to broaden people's perspectives to think that Laos is not just a bloody basket case that is doing everything wrong, but actually we can learn from a lot of things that are going on. And they've got this incredible history, particularly around cultivating a sense of it wasn't the government, it was us, sort of that this sort of grassroots, what they call grassroots mobilization. I think they've done it incredibly, and it's probably been the biggest learning point that I've had. I've had to overcome a lot of cynicism about, you know, the amount of time Lao people spend doing the state. Like I said before, that the state is quite distant in a way, but that's because it's also very close, in the sense that you could be the village chief. You could be the head of the village women's union. Like almost everybody at some point will have some kind of official role. And so it's not, the state is not sort of this sort of distant thing that sort of suddenly comes and imposes a law on you. People are allowed to make local ordinances, for instance, in Laos. So the village, at the village level, you can totally make local laws, you know, and be involved in that, which is a bit closer, I think, than the Australian system of a lot of people are disengaged from politics here, I would say. Yeah.
And there's, so you'd say there's more engagement amongst the citizenry in Laos?
Well, in terms of official roles, like the example I gave you of the chap whose job is to go around and collect money for the water users' fees to keep the local water clean, and he's, you know, he doesn't get paid for that. It's just something he does. It's one of his. Everybody sort of has official, contributes in some way to the local running of things. Yeah, so I think that gives people a sense of autonomy, ironically enough. Like, even though they're serving the state, it also is empowering in the sense that I think they feel a lot more, it's a lot more natural to them that they would make up local laws that affect them locally, such as we're going to close the village because there's a pandemic going on. It wouldn't even cross their mind that they don't have the capacity to do that. Of course they do, you know? Mm-hmm. Yeah, for them.
Interesting.
It's obvious. Yeah.
And so how do people, like, for example, the president, how does someone become the president or general secretary of the state of Laos?
So that's a really good question. So the president is usually a symbolic figure, like a head of state. So that's usually somebody who served in other political roles, like the more active roles, like the prime minister before. And there's been a bit of a change of guard recently in that earlier on, the high level political leaders were also the people who had led the war. And so they were people who had built up a lot of respect and credibility from their activities in the war. But these people have sort of passed on by and large. And so there was recently, there's been people serving as prime minister who don't have that background, but with the economic crisis, there's been a lot of questioning about the capacities of the leadership, and so interestingly, the son of one of the big leaders from the war era was appointed as prime minister. So a lot of people saw this as maybe a nepotism sort of thing, a little bit like, you know, having one President Bush and then another President Bush sort of thing, like instead of really expanding out to look for the best leader, it looks like they went for somebody who was safe because he had the right surname. So I have had people say to me that at the very top level, what's going on is a balance between the north, the centre and the south of Laos, because there wasn't historically that sense of this being one country. When they got together for the war, it was an anti-colonial war. They were all subject to French colonialism. So that's what really drew them together, not any sort of sense of we, the people of Laos, you know. There wasn't. So some people say that that's still an issue, like that politics at the top level is about satisfying these different factions from the different regional areas that they've all got a say. So the current prime minister is from the southern faction, and the previous prime minister was from the north. So, yeah, but like there's not much transparency about those decisions, a little bit like the Labour Party's caucus. these are secrets. Again, I see that through the democratic centralism idea, is that they have official channels for, you know, for, say, elections and voting and stuff. But when they vote in the National Assembly, for instance, the votes are not public. You know how in Australia you can look at somebody's voting record, you can look at a politician's voting record. That's not possible in Laos. People all express their opinions and then they go and vote, but the vote is private because they don't want there to be any discord long term. Like the point of the vote is to create unity. So it's not like, oh, these are the guys who voted for and these are the guys who voted against. It's like, okay, the whole National Assembly has voted for this. So the same with those high level politics. It's not advertised, say, or it's not reported on how these decisions are made. All that's reported on is that the decision was made, that this person would be prime minister, this person would be president, sort of thing. Yeah.
This is a 3CR Summer Breakfast Special, curated by 3CR's breakfast team, with episodes featuring old, new, and previously unaired content to ease you into your morning this summer.
You're on 3CR, our summer programming, and we're listening to a multi-part interview with Associate Professor Holly Hoy, speaking about Laos.
So the National Assembly is, these guys are, the people who serve in the National Assembly are representatives of areas in Laos. So they go back to the areas they represent and have meetings at the local level, and they're meant to talk about what's been going on in the National Assembly and get people's feedback and then take it back to the National Assembly. So when we're watching people's speeches, they in the National Assembly, they did stand up and say, you know, when I was at such and such a village, like, for instance, they were talking about, one person was very concerned about when he'd gone out on one of the consultation things, people had said, you know, look at this poor old man. He fought in the war. He gave everything. He sacrificed and he still doesn't have a pension. So he wanted to stand up in the National Assembly and say, what are we doing for our war heroes? You know, it's a shame that these people are living in squalor and poverty when they served our country. So that's an example of the, you know, what's supposed to happen. Of course, it's not a perfect system, but there's meant to be this direct loop, I guess, from the National Assembly back to the people that they represent, back to the National Assembly. And the other thing that happens is that once something is made into a policy, either because it's enacted as a law through the National Assembly or because the ministry releases it as a strategy document or some other kind of document, these then become policies that are enacted, but they have this feedback mechanism where there's meant to be there's this idea that you can't really assess a policy until it's in process, like until it's being rolled out, and then there's feedback. People are meant to comment on the policy once it's in action. So what I saw when I was following things like the attempt to roll out irrigation across rural Laos, which was a very top level strategy because they had this, you know, Politburo level big policy, which was about food security and about making Laos self-sufficient in food. So they just started rolling out all of these irrigation projects across the country. And of course, irrigation, when it gets going, is incredibly local in its technologies, in whether it will succeed or fail. And so I noticed a huge gap between the policies on document and then what was actually happening on the ground. A lot of researchers do, when they go to Laos, they say, you read the policy and it says one thing, and then you look at what people are doing in reality, it's completely different. And over time, I've come to understand this as that's part of the democratic centralist approach, which is that there's this, well, as it has evolved in Laos, shall we say, there's this constant attitude towards policy, which is that it's, you know, you implement it and then you look and see. You look and see how does it go and what do people say. And so that's another way that people have feedback, I think, is that is through what they actually do when policy arrives at their door in the form of a project or a requirement or something. there's a lot of latitude towards adapting it to local conditions. So in another research project I did was on cultural policies. So by cultural policies, I mean, like, what is the definition of culture, and what do they do in a multi-ethnic country about things like traditions of, say, debt marriages, where it was traditional to arrange marriages according to existing debts between families, often by children who are like babies. They would already be married off at a very young age. What do you do about multiple marriages, forced marriages? These are all questions about how policy and culture interact. So I was researching how this had rolled out in an ethnic minority village that had had quite a lot of these cultural practices, and yet conceived of themselves as model citizens. And so how could they think of themselves as model citizens, but at the same time, the village chief has three wives, which is against the law. So what I found is that the political culture in Laos is very much that policy is kind of like an ideal. It's a model. It's what we're working towards. And then there's the lived reality, which is often far from that. But the idea is not to sort of go around sort of shaming people for that. But the political philosophy is this, well, it's very much tied to this Marxist view of culture, which derives from Engels and his and some of that old school anthropology, like Lewis Henry Morgan, that cultures evolve and develop over time, and so this, the way this gets expressed in Lao cultural policies, is this sort of culture is this aspiration for improvement. So in this village, I was looking at, you know, that you can actually get a certificate which says that you're a cultured village. And a lot of villages recently have been certified as cultured villages. And so this is like a list that of things that you can check off. And so some of them are quite predictable, like you've got to have a festival every year that expresses your cultural identity. But others are much more intriguing, like a certain number of households have to own a television set or a radio. They have to have access to newspapers. You have to have a communication system in the village with like those loudspeakers. I don't know if you've been to Southeast Asia and noticed loudspeakers in villages. This is all part of what it is to be cultured, because culture is not just about retaining your sort of ethnic identity, but it's also about being informed, engaged, educated, and sort of aspirational. Yeah. So sorry, I can't remember how we got onto that topic. No, oh, we're talking about policy when it lands at people's doors. How do they interact with it? Yeah. So there's a lot. I found that there's a lot of space for people to interpret policy in ways that's livable for them. Mm. Yeah.
Very interesting. Thank you. I have one final question, but I also wanted to ask you if there was anything else you wanted to cover or talk about before I ask the final question, which is going to be around the country's plans for the future and challenges in the future. Is there anything you wanted to touch on?
Well, I'm just always happy to talk about Laos. So I'll just say to anybody that's listening, love to hear from you. And if you have any questions, feel free to reach out directly, because I'm always interested to know what other people find interesting in Laos. But that's it. I could talk for hours. But you wanted to talk about the future of Laos?
Yeah, I'm just wondering, you mentioned there's has been some economic challenges following COVID particularly. And I'm also wondering about external forces, looking at Cuba, for example. Cuba's under a lot of pressure at the moment after 60 years of unilateral sanctions, and things are probably the worst it's been in some time in Cuba because of those sanctions. And I'm hoping that's not that Laos has been under less pressure, and I think that's possibly true, but also, yeah, what are the challenges and the outlook for Laos?
Well, the biggest challenge is the economic situation. As I said at the beginning, the fallout from the pandemic and then the war in the Ukraine, interest rates has been pretty bad for the Lao economy. A lot of unemployment. So inadequate funding of education and health. So, what's the outlook for Laos? Well, I don't know. I don't think about the future much. I'm an anthropologist. I'm very much in the present. But what I'll tell you what I hope for Laos in the future. What I would love to see is more international recognition of the achievements Laos has made under incredibly difficult situations, and more openness towards perhaps learning from Laos and applying those lessons internationally. Like, I think we're probably all headed for difficult times in the future, not just Laos, probably the whole world. And I think we all need to think about how we can develop a sense of we-ness at the local level, so that whatever the future throws at us, we have some resilience and robustness. Because I think, you know, if a catastrophe hit tomorrow globally, I think a lot of people in Laos would be a lot better situated to survive than a lot of people in countries where that sense of socialness has been eroded. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thanks so much, Ali. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate it, and really appreciate the opportunity to learn more about what's happening in Laos and share that with the audience. And it's not a place that many people often think about or, you know, even know of. It's a small country and it's not spoken about much, but it's a place, like you mentioned, that's doing some very interesting and powerful and important things that we could definitely learn from. So I appreciate that opportunity very much.
Thank you so much. And we're just on my computer about to run out of batteries. So okay, perfect timing.
Perfect. Yeah. Thank you, Holly.
See you. Bye.
Yeah.
You're on 3CR. This is the Super Suckers with Roaming Around.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's independent radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs in the basement of Trades Hall in Victoria Street, Carlton. Keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.
This is 3CR's summer programming. This summer, 3CR Breakfast is featuring extended special event recordings and selected interview highlights from the past year, as well as some new culture and music-themed breakfast shows curated by our current affairs breakfast teams. Stay tuned to 3CR, and we look forward to returning to our regular programming in January.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.